sold or purchased? Horace, are we seeing the death of the salesman? You know, Steve Jobs built retail stores despite doubters to really improve and control the customer experience. Ford tried this in the late 90s, but ran into regulatory problems such as U.S. dealer networks and franchise laws. Yeah. Tesla, of course, is trying to go direct. BMW is thinking different with the I-Series buyer experience. And manufacturers are releasing showroom apps. So I purchased a few cars this year. I did most of my research online. It seems that, at least in the U.S., half the dealers are willing to email and haggle that way. Others, you must show up in person and deal with the old-style system. Is this going to change? Do you think Apple and Tesla's vision will succeed, or what's your sense?
Well, you know, the ability to integrate or disintegrate a value chain, or I should say the freedom to do so, is a function of, I believe, the health of an industry. So let me put it this way. Historically, industries have gone through either consolidation or value chain evolution in becoming more integrated, or the opposite, being more modular or horizontal. So historically, we've had industrial enterprises be very vertical, meaning that they were control over the means of production and the source materials was all within one, under one roof, one company. Famously, Henry Ford established the Ford production system, which meant that they owned not just the manufacturing plant, but also it built its own parts. It built its own supplier.
They had ships. Lots of pieces. Yeah.
And ultimately, they had control over the iron ore that was coming out of the mountains. So the idea was to also own all the way down to the showroom, and that broke up over time. Typically, the tendency is for that to become modular because there is a gain in distributing more broadly both the sources of supply and also the sources of market access. And then there's specialization, and people will say, hey, I can do a better job than your team can do internally if you give me this franchise, if you let me be a dealer. And so that makes sense, and over time you also take things off your balance sheet and you improve your return on capital, because it seems like you're doing as well with fewer assets, and that tends to be sort of an MBA mentality of optimization of various ratios, although they don't necessarily add value. But the point is not so much whether one is better than the other. That is really should be determined by the market and how and whether it, you can evolve. The evolution itself ought to be natural. It ought to be according to forces that are incident onto the system. Now, the problem is when you block either the evolution in one direction or whether you force it to go in another direction by law or by fiat. So the movie industry went through a phase where it was broken up because there were the breaking up took place between the studio production system and the movie theaters, and so the idea that was that there had to be government intervention to prevent the control over distribution. A lot of these things are politicized, however, because there's an interest in the little guy who has the vote in the politician's interests. The little guy wants to have a little bit of the action, a little bit of a piece of that action, and it's easy for government to step in and suggest that this is unfair, and therefore the antitrust laws also, you know, I'm not saying, again, it's a right or wrong thing, but there are issues around politics and whether these things are not entirely free to act. So the question is the car industry. The car industry went through this modularization where the dealerships became independent quite early, and as a result, they gained a huge amount of market power. The dealership network in the United States is so powerful that they often will dictate whether cars are designed a certain way, whether there's a certain type of portfolio of cars, and so their influence has been very strong, and not always in a good way. And they are protected from being integrated back in the value chain by law. So there are laws on the books that suggest that car manufacturers cannot sell direct. And maybe some states have those and some don't. And these laws are used as a shield to prevent actually entrants from coming in, because the entrant doesn't have a dealership network. What they have to typically do is buy into an existing network. So if you're a Hyundai or if you're a Jaguar or somebody who hasn't had a great lot of business in the U.S., you have to somehow gain access to the dealership networks. And that's what happens typically. It's not new dealerships are created, but existing dealers will take on multiple brands, will expand, and will do so. You know, it's up to them to decide whether they want to let you in or not. And sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and of course, all that simply means increasing returns to the existing structures, right? Because, you know, as you say, Hyundai and Kia and others, they're playing in the sandbox that exists, where Tesla is mm-hmm. trying something different, and they've been successful in a few states. But Texas, for example, has said no. The dealer lobby is very strong there.
Right. Well, so it's a complex issue that requires a state by state, country by country look. But I'm just broadly speaking, this is one of these things, a friction into the market. That why can't you just create a car company just like you do? And let's take the most trivial case. You and I set up an app development company. We sell apps next week. Not a problem. That can be done, right? There's zero barriers to entry, zero barriers to exit. This is classic Porter's theory of industry industry value, or how industries operate. And why are some industries able to allow entrants to come in and incumbents to exit? Usually this ability to enter and exit is fundamental to the rebirth and the rejuvenation of an industry. The problem with the car industry is just how rigid it is. It's very hard as an entrant to come in because you have all these rules and regulations. You have safety considerations. You have to have volume in order to meet the safety considerations. You have to have volume in order to meet a dealership network and criteria. And that means a lot of capital, because you have to build a big plant to be able to ship enough cars. It's a lot of risk. You won't be able to raise financing. You can't go to venture capital for stuff like this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the result is that the only people who play in the game are those who are in the game, either because they were established in another country or have been doing this for 100 years. So that's a serious problem, because that limits innovation, and the only people who are able to think about the industry are those who are in it. And typically, if you are in it, you've already know how it operates, and you will not change its operating model. That's where Tesla is so innovative and so exciting, because they're coming in as entrants. Plus, the mindset, it comes from a person who came out of technology. A lot of the individuals involved are coming from with a fresh perspective. And I think that's what this whole podcast series is about, is how does an industry change under coming in with a perspective that is from an outsider's view. Now, the point is that Tesla is trying, but you're seeing how hard it is for them to try to butt heads with this. One way to sort short circuit it is actually to be so compelling with your offering and saying, look, this is for the good of the country. This is good for the good of the world. People love our stuff. We're just doing a tremendous business in country, in states where we're free to do so. And why would you in Texas want to you as a politician or legislator in your state? Why would you want to prohibit the great people of the great state of Texas from having access to this great technology that everybody else loves, et cetera, et cetera? So you sort of have a moral argument, and then the laws are changed. You know. Good so luck. It could take 10 years, right? So that's the problem with that.
But I think you're getting at an important point. You know, are cars turning into something that's purchased rather than sold? Are we shifting to a bit of a more service world? You know, in the U.S. at least, and probably other parts of the world, there have been large companies that have been built big businesses on leasing cars, leasing fleets and all that. And that is a subtle way to route around the distribution channel. But again, not so much for you and I, but for the UPSs and the larger companies of the world.
The thing I'd like to point out is that the used car market is actually very liquid. The interesting thing to me is that the dealers have completely lost control of the used car market. I think mainly because of the way eBay works, for example. In the U.S., I bought a bunch of cars on eBay, and even if I were to buy or sell anything today, I would do it through eBay or its equivalent in any other country. The individual has been able to take control over the purchase and sale of...
Cut out the middleman, right?
Yeah, of used cars. The only weird thing is new cars... You can't buy direct. You know, I can't go online to eBay. What's happening is actually sort of because of the pressure, a lot of dealers are actually using eBay to sell new stuff, and their power is eroding. Although they're complicit to that erosion because they're like, well, this actually helps me out. You know, offloading stuff that I can't shift off the showroom, I'll put it on eBay. You know, first come, first serve, but. Ultimately, I don't know what that's going to do to the industry structure. The point is that the technology, you can see it's already having an impact. So in a way, I think that demand is evident through these new purchasing methods. The other thing I want to point out, though, is the service component. And this is actually one of the reasons people, I think, still go to dealers. It's that car ownership, like you pointed out, it becomes more about a service than an object you own. And the idea for a lot of people, because they're still afraid or things are confusing to them as far as what car service requires, and they have been led to be mistrustful of garages that are, you know, grease monkeys that are, you know, they're fixing cars as a hobby almost. And so they say, okay, professional, I want to go to a professional dealer that's certified, yeah. So what the problem is then that the dealerships depend more and more on service rather than the sale. And then the car makers are actually... giving that franchise, like you are a certified dealer, you're the only authority allowed to even work on the new car or relatively new car, and that means also you have access to all the technology needed to operate to fix new cars. So in a way, the problem I see though is that the dealership today, a dealership is a very expensive proposition, right? If you see a good sized dealership, it's a multi-million-dollar operation. I don't even know, maybe tens of millions of dollars. Oops, sorry about that.
Sure, mention the financing required to operate at the working capital.
Yes, but it's like it's a big, beautiful, shiny building. So I own a Mini, and we're servicing it at a BMW dealership. I used to have, in Finland, I still have in the U.S., but in Finland I used to have Mercedes, old Mercedes, and I would go to an independent mechanic, and you know, Mercedes mechanics are quite numerous in Europe, and that was a good experience. Although I can see how it could be perhaps not for everybody, because this man was really working by himself, and and he would write up your receipt by hand.
Sure.
And you know, it was a very, very old-fashioned way of doing things. And I liked it because I could talk to the guy for half an hour about my car.
Right,
he would
right.
just tell me everything. The point is, though, a dealer, now you go the opposite to a new, and I'm like amazed at these beautiful BMW dealership, multi-levels. It looks like, it's just like a museum. It's so beautiful. And I'm struck by that, and I'm thinking, how expensive is that, and why does the industry sustain this? So it's service, and it is an eye-watering experience to go to.
Wallet emptying service, yes, exactly.
Yeah, so I had one thing to do. My windows were not working properly. The way they are, push a button and it's supposed to go all the way down, and it wouldn't.
Right.
And they didn't know what the problem was. They said, we're going to have to simply reset and reprogram, quote unquote, reprogram the car. So that meant really probably just pushing a button or plugging in a serial cable and using your computer to sort of, tell it to reboot and reset the parameters on the computer. But that costs like, I don't know, the equivalent of about $100. And they went on and they said they had to also spend time to sort of reprogram, which I don't know. I suppose it means
software
loading
updates.
Up some software
sure.
update.
Sure.
I don't know what. But it ended up being quite an expensive thing. And I felt that was simply not value for the money.
So they're over-serving here with the...
Absolutely, absolutely. So, but it's kept still in a way off the people are people are kept ignorant about it, and that's
right.
never a good business model.
But aren't the car makers essentially growing their ecosystem by, you know, throwing in these maintenance plans? You know, I have a new GTI, and essentially Volkswagen gives you, I think, 3 years of maintenance, although. The hardcore people would say it's insufficient. You should double the oil changes and all that, which I do. But nevertheless, you know, it encourages you, and a number of them do that, to come to the dealer for your routine maintenance if you pay attention to that. So I think that's yet another increasing return example of keeping the dealers in the loop, where the independent folks, they don't have access.
There seems to be some collusion. I want to say that there's sort of an interdependency that's being built. I'll keep you happy if you keep me happy.
Right.
We're all in this together, and so on. And they're all operating the same way. And I think the problem is that if the manufacturer says, you know what, I think I want to change things a bit, I want to shift things around, the dealer network generally acts as they refuse to serve people well and ruin your brand image. That can happen, right? If it's almost as if they go on strike, like if they were employees, right? So they have this passive aggressive way of fighting back against what they don't like. And one thing, for example, they may not like in electric cars is that they don't require service. If they don't require service, then there goes your whole business plan as a dealer. And you'd have to make the money on, and I think that's the calculation that Tesla is making. You have to, if you don't make money on the service, you have to make money on the sale. The problem is that consumers are wise to that, so they're not going to pay extra. They'll shop around and they'll go direct if they can, and so that goes. That means it disappears any of the value of the network. It's not that they're against dealerships in general. It's just that the dealership business model is not sustainable when it comes to Tesla as the product, and so that gets into this whole discussion that. Could a powertrain, and I think we talked about this, could a new powertrain, which seems to have nothing to do with the foundations of what a car does and how it is built and what the economics of ownership are, might even be worse in some directions. But because of the service thing, it's almost like a footnote, it might actually undermine the whole dealership network, thus causing a complete change in value structure of the industry, because then there's more integration, and perhaps Tesla can then actually iterate differently than it does today. Perhaps because they're free of the dealership network, they can actually move more quickly, launch more product, do different things, really, really innovate on the product side. And that's where we don't know. I'm just saying that that's one of the things, one of these weird consequences, the unintended consequences of changing the structure of the industry.
They build the moat so wide that eventually it floods the whole thing, and there you are.
Yeah, and I believe strongly that, again, the trouble with Tesla has been that they're starting and trying to gain a foothold in the most difficult market you can imagine to do so, right? It's the most rigid, it's the most competitive, has the most choice, has the lowest price typically for fossil carbon-based fuels, and so you have that situation where you would set yourself the most difficult goal imaginable. Imagine instead if you would set up an electric car business in places which have no cars, poor infrastructure, you know, that getting solar power, for example, in a sunny place let me cut to the chase. I think the most natural place for a new car company like Tesla would have been Africa, you know, set up in Kenya.
At a different price point, of course.
Of course, but yes. Then you'd say, you know, you would have control over all the pieces in the puzzle, right?
Right.
Could say, hey, you know, we're not going to make a luxury car. We're going to make a sort of a Jeep-like car. We're going to sell it at super dirt low prices. We're going to sell it together with a solar kit that you put on your roof of your house to charge the thing up. And if you have excess energy, then you can bottle it as hydrogen and then sell that in the open market like you do. What I love is this SodaStream. SodaStream sells...
Right.
It sells you these little CO2 containers. Well, why can't you have CO2 containers that actually hold hydrogen that's been converted from water through electrolysis because you have excess solar power? Instead of using that, you know, what happens is that I don't know if you're familiar with the solar systems, but typically the problem with solar is that it gives you energy when you don't need
it. You don't need it, right.
And
you have to store it.
So you need batteries to really make it functional. But in places where actually consumption is low and insulation is high, it makes a lot of sense to just bottle it up. Bottle up energy, bottle up the sun in a container. And then you could actually then think, well, solar is cool. Yeah, we can use batteries, but maybe batteries would be better replaced by hydrogen cylinders. And then you start to think of hydrogen as a battery. Your mind reels at all these possibilities to completely reinvent transportation because you're not competing with consumption. You're competing with non-consumption. You're competing with a person who doesn't have a car. China is an interesting case in point. China didn't have a lot of cars, but their production has now gone to the level where it's above the United States when it comes to cars.
But they have cut deals with all the incumbents. I mean, example of very strong state relationships with the traditional players.
Yeah. So the way the Chinese, and by this I mean the Chinese Communist Party, the bureaucratic class, lots of smart people. In fact, if you're smart in China, your ambition is primarily to work for the government,
sure.
which means it attracts
it's the
best and brightest,
yep.
Right? What happens is all these bright people, you know, are writing policy. And one of the policies is, for example, to subsidize electric vehicles. They've had tremendous success getting rid of polluting two-cycle engines, which besides a bicycle, the next evolution is usually you get a moped. And the moped built, you know, most of Southeast Asia, as far as that's the default mode of transportation, for example, in Vietnam and Indonesia and other places. And the problem with those is they're very polluting. And for a population like China and the urban population, like in most of China's cities, that creates so much pollution that it's unacceptable. And so one of the things they've done is actually banned, completely made illegal, two-stroke engines. So what that meant is that suddenly there was this huge boost, not in cars, but in actually in electric mopeds, in basically bicycles with electric motors, and those took off. And just during the mid 2000s, that was like a huge phenomenon in most of China. Then they quickly moved to cars, which were four stroke, and that was because they had cheap loans, and everybody was able to make cars, but they didn't really innovate on the concept of a car. Now they're trying to, and this is all because simply somebody wrote down a memo. You know, ultimately it's like they
command and control. Checks. Of course. Yes.
Yeah, it's command and control. And so there wasn't a market force for a lot of this. There's always a huge amount of demand, but they didn't sort of do the allocation of resources in a way that the market said that's the best way. So just cutting through skipping a little bit here, fast forwarding in the thought, but the point is that you have now a situation where they're trying to get away from four-stroke engines altogether and move to electric, but they're doing it again by command and control, and they're saying we're going to have subsidies, we're going to encourage battery manufacturers, we're going to encourage this and that. By the way, they encourage solar manufacturers, which caused a huge crash in the global market for solar, and actually caused people to run away from renewables. It's unbelievable because China is such a huge force. It is in the world but they're, you can't look to them for inspiration.
No,
sort
it's
of
a sustaining market, really, in many ways.
Yeah, the way the Communist Party will make decisions will be very much in a sustaining model, because what they're going to think about are best practices, what is the smart way to do things, because that is, you know, they'll do a lot of studying of what's the current status, right? And they'll take the best that they can see. The problem is that when you don't know, maybe there's a new way that you haven't discovered that no one's discovered.
The naive question never arises. Yeah.
Yes, yes, and
So routing around this, you know, maybe there's an example in the aircraft industry. 30 years ago, a guy named Stephen Udvar Hazy started International Lease Finance, a tiny little company, and so he became the king of aircraft leasing. He's still around, and grew to be so powerful that he could dictate models and financing and all those things with the two major airplane builders. And today we see a little bit of that in some markets. San Francisco and the U.S. and a few other cities have car sharing services. So do you see the job to be done, the change being that I purchase a car service and therefore I don't care about the dealer, somebody else is abstracting that and dealing with that, and therefore the car services begin to eat more of the value, and that drives the change?
Very good point, because again, like I said, you simply see a small crack in a pressurized system.
Yes.
If the industry is under a lot of pressure because there's no innovation, because it's pretty much been blocked every time you try, and yet there's a lot of pressure for innovation because no one's making money. Number one. Number two, they're political forces of, you know, we can't go on like this with fuels and so on. And when you have that situation, every little crack can turn into a catastrophe. So one crack could be like you break the power of dealers. But another one, like you point out, is like if you completely go around the whole question of ownership. So you attack the problem, like you said, by saying it's not so important that you buy and own the car, but rather, and by the way, this is another thing with driverless cars, is that the idea behind that concept that is potentially disruptive isn't that there's anything wrong with driving. There's nothing I see as a problem with being a driver. But the problem is, I think, that it would allow the ownership or the car or the transportation job to be done, to be changed dramatically, right? It would mean that you don't have to own a car anymore. You would simply have like what you mentioned with aircraft, you don't need to own them. You don't need to put them on your balance sheet.
Sure, the financing, the maintenance, the acquisition, the insurance.
Exactly.
Everything is taken care of. I write one check, or I give them a credit card, and I have the aircraft, right? It's all
But
done.
This is, again, the problem with a lot of these great ideas is that you see how difficult it is to put in practice, because with the car business, you have so many laws are written on the premise of ownership and on the premise of taxation that goes...
Right.
against that logic, parking, every single detail, right? Going on, they want to have congestion charges now and all these other things. And so who pays for the sort of the taxes and the governmental structure of maintenance? Sort of, I see it, let me put it in another framework. I see the car as like the phone, and I see everything else around that car as the mobile phone network. And the mobile
it's
phone
a good segue network, to our second subject, yes.
Well, the mobile phone network is $1.3 trillion, but the phone business is only about $300 billion. So there's a factor
of four.
So
who's in charge?
Yeah, so who's the tail and who's the dog, right? So that's more, I mean, maybe the scale isn't the same, but you try to add up the cost of the roads in the world. You try to add up the cost of fuel infrastructure just to feed these cars. And the car becomes really more symbolic of a very complex system. And that's really when you start to say, well, let's play a game with the car. Let's change it completely. You realize that everything else is depending upon sort of suckling at the that car's life, and
sure.
that funds everything
else.
The
whole thing is a big domino game, yeah.
Yeah. So sometimes you say, well, maybe you get away from having a car at all, and then we get into other forms of transport. But it's one of these things that you need to have, and I use this phrase in a recent. I was asked by Eric Jackson to answer some questions. I use this phrase, systems analysis. Systems analysis is kind of a funny old, dusty old phrase from the 1970s, where there are people whose job it was to be systems analysts because computing solutions, which were essentially mainframe based, were thought of as systems with interdependencies, and you had to have somebody who looked at the whole picture. And that's fallen out of use as a not just as a job title, but as something people do, because now with specialization, everything's modular, right? And you can just study one module.
Software architects and hardware architects, chip designers, all that.
Yeah. So the point being, though, that an industry like automobiles and transportation is a huge system, and I think it needs to be understood in all of its facets. And few people are expert in even two, never mind dozens, right? You'd have to be a real like a think tank, PhD who's been sitting in academia for 20 years writing papers. That's the sort of person you might have seen all the bits and bobs and all the data associated with such a massive system. But nobody really takes their opinion seriously because they tend to be theoretical.
So if we take a global view of the auto infrastructure, and then as we try to do occasionally, look at the mobile space, this whole business of seeking a low-cost iPhone, which I found last week when I put gas in my car and there was a sign there that said at the gas station, $35 a month iPhone, which I found humorous. Is this an example of the challenges of the entrenched system, where the tech business was seeking a low-cost iPhone? Apple delivered something different. But when we look at the ecosystem, the infrastructure, maybe that is where they are. After all, Steve Jobs introduced a different model with the first iPhone, and it didn't last very long. So is that the fate of the car business? Are we stuck with this? Or what's your sense?
Well, it's hard to generalize a bit. I mean, firstly, the car business does have and has managed to give us a huge amount of choice. There are so many car models. There are so many price points available. There's no lack of choice. But what we tend to get is that the product itself, in the job it's designed to do, is very, very much constant. I think that the phone business in some ways is actually going to evolve closer to the car industry in terms of having The idea of like what we're seeing with the five S and C is more like, you know, the model refresh that happens on the yearly cycle, the facelifting that happens with cars to get them sort of freshened up a bit so that they can be competitive a bit longer. And yet the ownerships, the ownership of phones, and the, so in other words, there will be naturally a slowing down of the improvement of phones because they've become good enough. And once they become good enough, you'll see more price points. You'll see more emphasis on adjusting the same thing. But the phone business is just but one part of the whole computing world, and I think that they've simply converged phones and or telephony and computing, and all of computing, if you take that as a frame of reference, it is far more dynamic because we're going to probably introduce new forms of computing in the future as new interfaces are possible: voice, vision, gestures. And you know, not to speak of, you know, whatever else we can trap from our intentions. But so I expect there still will be waves of improvement in the computing world, and it isn't as rigid as the automobiles have become. So I'm not sure I'm answering the question.
I think I was sort of driving at, you know, is that In the mobile space of the computing world, is the ecosystem now so powerful? And do you see the seeds of that, whether it's the traditional players in the automotive industry or the Teslas, trying to do some of that, and therefore the value, the perceived value, changes to the services, the ecosystem, and the implications for that, both from the buyers and the existing players?
Well, yeah, I think that... Well, we sort of touched on this. The whole ecosystem game is one aspect. So let me step a moment back. So here's, we have the clash of theories. One theory that we've known for a long time is disruption theory. That is governing how many industries function. But the computing industry is also governed by two other theories, which, again, I emphasize word theory because they're only right now observed, not in any way seen as law. So one theory is that ecosystems matter, and the idea is that this comes from the old days when software, when Microsoft developed software that allowed third-party apps or third-party applications at the time. And so the ecosystem that Microsoft built around Windows forced people to stick with it, even if there were, quote, better, right? In that the force of a disruption may happen, the point is people won't switch, and
they're prisoners. Fired for buying IBM, right?
Yeah, and so for the shift to happen from IBM to Microsoft, and then from Microsoft to mobile, these shifts have actually been very asymmetric. And ultimately the people who developed for the older platform would either die off,
right, most times,
or be replaced with, mm-hmm, you know, a fresh blood. Right. But there's ecosystems, and the other one is sort of related, which is network effects.
Right.
That the more people that use a platform, the more valuable it becomes, and so in many ways, network effects and ecosystems were the law of the land for the 90s, even before disruption theory was known as or taken in and absorbed as a theory. And it is sort of a clash of theories in a way, because in one sense you have a prediction made by disruption theory that an incumbent is vulnerable. But that incumbent, because they have an ecosystem and a platform which has network effects, is invulnerable to disruption. You see, so
right,
that's the
right
problem, is that
the paradox.
You have, who's right here? And this is why, you have room for debate. You have room to debate whether Apple, for example, is really vulnerable to the low end, because what they're doing is, firstly, they're not ignorant of it. Secondly, they're using network effects and they're using ecosystems to protect themselves. And they could survive longer with that strategy and maybe head them off at the pass by simply building a low-end product only when it's really necessary, and they don't have to flee up market. In fact, that's what the 5C is doing, that they're not seeing, oh dear, here come the Chinese, let's just abandon the mid and the low. They've actually said, no, we're actually going to move our ASP down. And anyway, I don't want to turn this into another 5C discussion.
So we see the car industry trying new things, you know, whether it's connected cars or apps that perform certain jobs, or, you know, in the case, I think, Volkswagen and Google have a deal where the user's information is sent up to the cloud and Google does whatever it does. We've talked about that a bit in the past. But car makers thinking really different hasn't generally succeeded, right? I mean, they have these sort of sustaining things, you know, we'll sell you insurance, roadside service, OnStar, long-term service plans. But when they've really thought different, whether it's Ford with the Tri-Motor, Henry Ford trying to get into the tire business in Brazil, failing, Honda's jet business, you mentioned Kaiser recently with cars.
Yeah, Kaiser is a great example, because Kaiser is the one who, you know, this is Kaiser of the Kaiser Permanente, which was the first HMO, but before he did that HMO, which was actually only to help out his employees, but he built the Liberty ships, and before that he was a partner in the building of the Hoover Dam, and then the other dams on the West Coast, and he pretty much built the infrastructure of the whole West Coast of the United States, plus many other places. But anyway, Kaiser, after the war, after having built a few thousand ships, he set his eyes on the car industry, and he actually created a car which he built in the former plant that used to make airplanes, the Willow Run plant in Michigan, and that used to make the B-24s, made thousands of them. And so he bought that plant and decided to make a car. He said the America is ready for the low end, and his car was a low end, very cheap car. I wouldn't call it like as a Jeep, but it had that sort of I don't even remember its name, but it was basically built out of the logic of the war, which was absolutely squeezing as much cost out of production and as make it as rapidly as possible, right? And volume and scale. And it was a very much a wartime mentality applied to manufacturing of vehicles in the car industry. The car industry, by the way, was largely responsible for the ability of the U.S. to produce as much as it did. Right. So after the war, they had this huge amount of capacity and skill and everything else. But he turned this. So while after the war, the marketing guys took over from the production guys. And the marketing guys at every other car company in the U.S. said, Americans want now lavish cars. They want to go back to a life.
The good times.
The good times. So, you know, GM and Ford started making the cars which they felt the customers wanted. And whereas Kaiser sort of became asymmetric in the approach, said, "Well, no, they really want cheap," and it turns out they did. They didn't, and so he lost everything in that venture. Arguably, the funny thing is, here's the funny thing: whereas Americans were splurging on cars in the 50s, the Europeans were starving, and so the Europeans turned to the low end, and that's where we had the Volkswagen, that's where we had
the
Cinquecento in Italy, we had the French with their 2CV, and then we had the British with the Mini, although that came a bit later, but still, all of the European countries, it devised a low-end product. And because the world was less globalized back then, Henry Kaiser couldn't just shift production to Europe, right? And he couldn't sell his stuff there. He tried to move some of that production and some of the excess inventory to South America. That didn't work either. So you know, he folded up and essentially the whole venture was a write-off. But you can see how timing plays a part in this game. He had very much a Henry Ford attitude. He had all of the pieces at his disposal, but the timing was all wrong. And so I don't know if the industry took a big note out of that and said, you know, we meaning GM and so on, they prospered through the 50s and 60s making essentially market-driven product. They simply doubled down on not on innovation. They doubled down on decoration. They doubled down on ostentation.
Sure.
And it worked. It just worked up until it didn't. And then, again, history isn't giving us a consistent picture. We're not seeing a great example. So how come it works in Europe and doesn't work in the U.S. in the 1940s? How come it worked in the 20s in the U.S. with Henry Ford, but it didn't work in the 40s? How come whatever
1970s with Japan, right?
Right. Whatever America was doing was seen as absolutely miraculous, and everybody wanted to emulate, but they couldn't come close. Right. American cars were light years ahead of everything else in the world. If you look even in the parking lot in the 1960s in the U.S. versus, for example, Great Britain, it looks like there's a 20-year gap. And Japan and everybody else learned from America, and then America completely lost the way, right? And in the 1970s and 80s, it was as if they completely exhausted.
Lost contact with the customer, of course.
So you're on top, and then you're on the bottom, and then maybe you can do a comeback. So car industry is filled with apparently random shifts, and that's why. You know, if you're a student of business, you say, well, there's no logic to any of this, right? It just
Why
comes
go to school,
down to
right?
being lucky. You're either lucky or you know, you're at the right place at the right time, or somebody's charismatic. That's why we get the charismatic leader theory of saying success is down to the individual.
Well, I think your example of Kaiser is great, because if you look at Honda with their Jet today or the Ford Tri-Motor of many years ago, certainly those initiatives take
a
leader.
I forgot to mention,
pull it off, right?
Tri-Motor is another great story. I mean, you've got to read up on this thing. It's fascinating, because Ford, here's Ford. He figures out not just the car, but he figures out the car as an integrated thing, which means he understands production. I cannot overstate the idea of mass production that Henry Ford was able. Mass production was not was not invented by Henry Ford. A lot of people say that, but in fact, mass production began in the 19th century. There were many manufacturing businesses in the 19th century which built everything. I think the very first mass-produced thing was actually a gun, because it needed, you know, it was needed in large quantities, and it needed to be standardized, and it needed to be manufactured to high tolerances, and so people worked out how to do that. But then, you know, there were clothing was another huge industry in the 19th century that was based on machinery. But Henry Ford brought it into a new era where not only did they make things in huge quantities, but they were able to do high precision, high complexity technology products. Cars in very short time frames to such a low price point that even the workers that work there, which by the way, you know, auto workers were not known to be high wage earners at the time, right? They were relatively unskilled workers, so they could afford to buy a car. And so that's what he did, and he motorized the whole society as a result. But the Henry Ford production system had its weaknesses, and one of them was exploited by GM later, because Ford could not change over its models.
Right.
They were designed to make one thing, and they ran
huge
that same
volumes, right?
that
For
same
years.
Product.
Yes.
Yeah, and so GM introduced the idea of revising a new model every year. So GM, and this is Knudsen. Yeah, this other innovator at General Motors, and he devised a system where you could change the model you produce every year. And that was a revolution that pretty much caused Ford almost to go out of business. But before he went through that crisis, Henry Ford also said, why don't I apply my production system to airplanes? Because the airplane was starting to become a viable commercial product by the 1920s. And aviation was emerging from the Second World War, I mean, the First World War, and people were, at first, there wasn't really a job to be done for aviation except war and mail. Mm-hmm. These were the only things that people, and because it was so dangerous and so many fatalities that only daredevils would take to the air. And since that didn't matter so much in the war, because, you know, people were dying all over the place, it was adopted by militaries. But as far as being civil aviation, that didn't take place even in the 1920s because reliability was not good enough. But it was getting to that point, and Ford said, look, there's nothing unique about an airplane that we don't know how to build one, because we have cars. We have the knowledge to make cars, and so we have the knowledge to make engines. And an airplane is nothing more than an engine in an airframe. So they got into making the tri-motor, which is the three-engined airplane that was probably the first mass-produced civil aviation transport. But it wasn't profitable. And I think the reason Ford stopped it is because there were so many complexities with respect to the airline relationship with airlines. Airlines came to be the actual profit source, right? It was the service part that was more valuable
than the product.
Right? Than the product part. Mm-hmm. And the airlines turned out to have a great deal of say in what airplanes were built. And to this day, you can't go and build an airplane because you think it's the best thing ever. You have to consult with airlines, and unless they place orders, you don't even begin to build one. So the that was starting to be an issue, and the airline industry went through various crises in the 1920s and 30s. And this is why all the aircraft makers that emerged had no relationship at all to the automakers. The airplane companies, Glenn, Curtiss, Douglas, obviously of Wright, although Wright didn't make airframes, they only made engines. Later on, their interests were sold to an engine and parts maker. But the initial Lockheed and all these guys who were Boeing, all of these guys were actually entrepreneurs who decided to get into the plane making business, and none of the incumbents from the auto industry managed to transition to plane making. Fascinating. I haven't really explored it further than that, but I think it's fascinating how you can see that even though the skills, in other words, the resources and processes
are similar,
are very similar, and the technology was very similar, because again, for most of that century,
sure,
most of the last
engine,
century up until I'd say the 1960s, yeah, the determining factor to the quality of an airplane was its engine. The determining factor to whether a plane would go faster, higher, be more reliable, carry more people was the power of the engine. And you can follow that power curve as it went from more and more sophisticated internal combustion up until turbines took over, and then on through the evolution of that of turbine efficiency. But they're all essentially, you can plot the graph of engine power and see that that's what drove the industry. And yet the auto industry was the one who came up and had to solve the problems of internal combustion and mass manufacturing. It wasn't the airframe guys and you know, processes of riveting and processes of welding or anything like that. That was relatively low tech. The aerodynamics was relatively well understood. So there wasn't, the real problem was manufacturing of engines. And again, you would expect that the car guys would work it out. Put it in the modern context. It's like saying Intel And maybe it is an interesting example. Intel makes microprocessors. They figured out the engine part of the vehicle, and they're making these great microprocessors, getting them better and better, but they can't somehow transition into mobile. Right. Even though, well, in this case, the analogy kind of breaks down. The mobile chips are actually less powerful, whereas the car engines were less powerful than the as incumbents than the airplane engines. But it seems to me that car guys should have gotten into the plane business, and the aircraft industry grew up on its own and completely different. And I think a lot has to do with some of these externalities to the core product, the relationship between entities in the value chain, the engine makers, the frames, the modularity question, the regulation question, the intermediaries like the service component of the airlines, the role of government, obviously very important there, because they more or less through their spending on defense, they
influenced the
flooded
the
capital. They were the venture capital of the day. They were providing all the startup capital to do all these amazing innovations, which frankly no one could have gotten funded without the government. So who does the government fund but those who know how what they're doing? They're not going to fund the crazy guy who has a harebrained idea.
But in that example, it was interesting because, you know, Boeing owned an airline for a while, United, actually, what became United, and or at least pieces of it. So maybe we see in the automakers thinking different. The strong leadership launches a different product, but perhaps the real deal was seeking more or a larger ecosystem or a different ecosystem, because of course if you own an airline and if you can do it effectively, there's a channel for your product. And it's interesting because that argument has been made in the mobile space that some of the manufacturers should own their own MVNO, right, their own virtual network. Or in the car space, does that mean that the manufacturers will get more into these car sharing services? And BMW is sort of talking about that with their electric cars, you know, giving the ability, if you have one of those, either lease or own, you'll have the ability to use an SUV for a week or two, so it becomes more of a service. And I think that can tell us something over time as we look at these businesses, where the change might occur. If the buyers begin to value the service more, the ecosystem, let's say, maybe that's what drives change as opposed to the incumbents trying.
Yeah, you know, in the case, so just go backing up a little bit, in the case where Boeing did own an airline, and there was that, again, that relationship that existed naturally, but the government stepped in and said, no, you can't do that. And right. This is what the crisis. And I think the reason was that government was a big buyer, and they didn't want, you know, the power of the suppliers to be too strong. So the government was buying, by the way, on the airline business, the government was buying the transportation of mail. And they didn't want collusion to happen between airlines, and they didn't want a certain degree of control. And I forget exactly, but there were scandals, and usually governments act when they're embarrassed, and there was some scandal about the corruption of some mail delivery that forced this catastrophe of intervention. So let's not necessarily draw too many conclusions as to whether Boeing was right or wrong in owning an airline. But yeah, the point about going back forward to your point about BMW and others wanting to become service businesses, I think it makes a lot of sense. I used this word recently called servitization, and then it was a word that came to me via an academic effort that I was exposed to long ago. But it basically, the theory, a lot of people are studying this in either in economics or business schools, and the premise of servitization is that every product business eventually becomes a service business. And the example I would give is if you're doing mostly industrial equipment or industrial product, the service component is usually much bigger than the actual first sale. Elevators are a case in point.
Sure, medical equipment is a good example. There's
and
lots of that.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. You see that when it's B2B. Typically, B2B, a business will not care so much about the product. They want you there and as somebody who is going to answer the phone.
Sure, they want reliability.
When something goes wrong. Mm-hmm. Yeah, reliability is way more important than the function of the product or the quality of whatever you want to define the metric of performance.
The mini showroom.
In that sense, already, sir. Yeah, the servitization is very important already in industrial or B2B business. But in the consumer space, we're seeing it in sort of veiled ways. We're seeing it, as I pointed out, that the iPhone really feels at the end of the day more as a service. And what Apple is really doing is tapping into your phone bill every
sure,
month.
It's a gateway.
If you follow the money, that's how it...
Exactly.
Yeah, and cars are similar in a way because what they're saying is that you buy the car, you get good quality service, you might as well lease the car anyway.
Right.
And it's essentially a monthly payment you're getting for transportation, and you don't feel at the end, you know, you just get a new car when 3 years later you just refresh the vehicle. And that's a service business, but it's still, I think, somehow hasn't crossed the chasm to be, in some people's minds, this is the case, but in most people's minds, they still have this ownership notion in their minds. And I haven't really thought it through and why we haven't evolved to the point where that is the default state. You know, you would expect by now, if somebody had created a really tight tight business model around leasing, why we're not all leasing today 100%, and we don't even, and leasing itself evolved to the point where you just think of the monthly bill and people, you have aggregators and people who come in just like the mobile operators do, and MVNOs appear, and essentially you have leasing companies who step in between the manufacturer and you, and then they simply give you a service and say, sign here and you guarantee to have a fresh car every 2 years. And you don't even have to worry about which car. We'll pick one. We'll get you a nice one.
Yeah, I think we can sort of wrap up with my assertion, and I think it's an information problem because in the car space, you have such wide range of use and experiences. So the person that drives that Mercedes that you bought at a good value because they only drove it 5,000 kilometers a year versus another person who might drive it 60,000 kilometers a year, you know, doing a lease deal and protecting yourself was fairly complicated. But now, with connected cars, with insurance companies doing sort of mileage and route-based pricing, I think we'll probably get closer to that in the next 5 years. Of course, what that means and who has that data, who owns it, I think I posted on the River Cisco valued a car's data at $1,400 or $1,500 a year. So if we see, again, that layer, that metadata above the car develop, maybe that'll open the door to these service models.
Yeah, you're right. I think you're absolutely right. And I think this is why we're having this conversation. This is why we're having this podcast, is to think through the information angle, which is yet another layer into this space, which I think has not been explored. I sometimes just ask these questions because I haven't thought them through yet, and then you know your hypothesis pops into that question and completely seems to solve it. I there's a lot of details still we need to think about.
We have time in future podcasts to cover that. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's exactly the whole point. As we move to become more information driven, the impact on so many industries will be profound, and I think cars are not immune to that.